That is to say, we churchmen do not exhaust each other's hospitality, but rather require that of the laity, giving them thus an opportunity to serve God in honouring and relieving his appointed servants.
It is true, replied Wamba, that I, being but an ass, am nevertheless honoured to bear the bells as well as your reverence's mule. Notwithstanding, I did conceive that the charity of Mother Church and her servants might be said, with other charity, to begin at home.
A truce to thine insolence, fellow, said the armed rider, breaking in on his prattle with a high and stern voice, and tell us, if thou canst, the road to— How'd you call your Franklin, Prior Emma?
Cedric, answered the prior. Cedric, the Saxon, tell me, good fellow, are we near his dwelling, and can you show us the road?
The road will be uneasy to find, answered
Girth, who broke silence for the first time,
and the family of Cedric retire early to rest. Tush, tell me not, fellow, said the military rider. 'Tis easy for them to arise and supply the wants of travellers such as we are, who will not stoop to beg the hospitality which we have a right to command.
I know not, said Girth sullenly, if I should show the way to my master's house, to those who demand as a right the shelter which most are fain to ask as a favour.
Do you dispute with me, slave? Said the soldier,
and setting spurs to his horse, he caused him make a demi-volt across the path, raising at the same time the riding-rod which he held in his hand, with the purpose of chastising what he considered as the insolence of the peasant. Girth darted at him a savage and revengeful scowl, and with a fierce yet hesitating motion laid his hand on the haft of his knife. But the interference of Prior Aymer, who pushed his mule betwixt his companion and the swineherd, prevented the meditated violence.
Nay, by St. Mary, Brother Briand, you must not think you are now in Palestine, predominating over heathen Turks and infidel Saracens. We islanders love not blows, save those of Holy Church, who chasteneth whom she loveth. Tell me, good fellow, said he to Wamba, and seconded his speech by a small piece of silver coin, the way to Cedric the Saxon's. You cannot be ignorant of it, and it is your duty to direct the wanderer even when his character is less sanctified than ours.
In truth, venerable father, answered the jester, the Saracen head of your right reverend companion has frightened out of mind the way home. I'm not sure I shall get there tonight myself.
Tush, said the abbot, thou canst tell us if thou wilt. This reverend brother has been all his life engaged in fighting among the Saracens for the recovery of the Holy Sepulchre. He is half a monk, half a soldier.
If he is but half a monk, said the jester, he should not be wholly unreasonable with those whom he meets upon the road, even if they should be in no hurry to answer questions that no way concern them.
I forgive thy wit, replied the abbot, on condition thou wilt show me the way to Cedric's mansion.
Well then, answered Wamba, your reverences must hold on this path till you come to a sunken cross, of which scarce a cubit's length remains above ground. Then take the path to the left, for there are four which meet at Sunken Cross, and I trust your reverences will obtain shelter before the storm comes on.
The abbot thanked his sage adviser, and the cavalcade, setting spurs to their horses, rode on as men do who wish to reach their inn before the bursting of a night storm. As their horses' hooves died away, Girth said to his companion,
"If they follow thy wise direction, the reverend fathers will hardly reach Rotherwood this night."
No, said the jester, grinning, but they may reach Sheffield if they have good luck, and that is as fit a place for them. They're not so bad a woodsman as to show the dog where the deer lies, if I have no mind he should chase him.
Thou art right, said Girth. It were ill that Aymer saw the Lady Rowena, and it were worse, it may be, for Cedric to quarrel, as is most likely, with this military monk. But, like good servants, let us hear and see and say nothing.
We return to the riders, who had soon left the bondsman far behind them, and who maintained the following conversation in the Norman-French language usually employed by the superior classes, with the exception of the few who are still inclined to boast their Saxon descent.
"'What mean these fellows by their capricious insolence?' said the Templar to the Cistercian. "'And why did you prevent me from chastising it?'
"'Marry, Brother Briand,' replied the prior. "'Touching the one of them, it were hard for me to render a reason for a fool speaking according to his folly, and the other churl is of that savage, fierce, intractable race, some of whom, as I have often told you, are still to be found among the descendants of the conquered Saxons, and whose supreme pleasure it is to testify by all means in their power their aversion to their conquerors. "'I would sooner beat him into courtesy,' observed Briand. "'I'm accustomed to deal with such spirits. "'Our Turkish captives are as fierce and intractable as Odin himself could have been, "'yet 2 months in my household, under the management of my master of the slaves, "'has made them humble, submissive, serviceable, and observant of your will. "'Marry, sir, you must beware of the poison and the dagger, "'for they use either with free will when you give them the slightest opportunity.' "'Aye, but,' answered Prior Aymer, "'every land has its own manners and fashions. "'And besides that, beating this fellow could procure us no information "'respecting the road to Cedric's house. "'It would have been sure to have established a quarrel "'betwixt you and him had we found our way thither. "'Remember what I told you. "'This wealthy Franklin is proud, fierce, jealous, and irritable, "'a withstander of the nobility, and even of his neighbours, "'Reginald Franc de Boeuf and Philippe Malvoisin, "'who are no babes to strive withal.' He stands up so sternly for the privileges of his race, and is so proud of his uninterrupted descent from Hereward, a renowned champion of the Heptarchy, that he is universally called Cedric the Saxon, and makes a boast of his belonging to a people from whom many others endeavour to hide their descent, lest they should encounter a share of the vae victis, or severities imposed upon the vanquished. "'Prior Aymer,' said the Templar, "'you're a man of gallantry, learned in the study of beauty, and as expert as a troubadour in all matters concerning the arrests of love, but I shall expect much beauty in this celebrated Rowena, to counterbalance the self-denial and forbearance which I must exert if I am to court the favour of such a seditious churl as you have described her father, Cedric.' "'Cedric is not her father,' replied the prior, "'and is but of remote relation.' She is descended from higher blood than even he pretends to, and is but distantly connected with him by birth. Her guardian, however, he is, self-constituted, as I believe, but his ward is as dear to him as if she were his own child. Of her beauty you shall soon be judge, and if the purity of her complexion and the majestic yet soft expression of a mild blue eye do not chase from your memory the black-tressed girls of Palestine, I, or the houris of old Mahoun's paradise, I am an infidel and no true son of the church. Should your boasted beauty, said the Templar, be weighed in the balance and found wanting, you know our wager. My gold collar, answered the prior, against 10 butts of Cayenne wine. They are mine as securely as if they were already in the convent vaults under the key of old Dennis the cellarer. And I am myself to be judge, said the Templar, and am only to be convicted on my own admission that I have seen no maiden so beautiful since Pentecost was a 12-month. Ran it not, sir? Prior, your collar is in danger. I will wear it over my gorget in the lists at Ashby de la Zouche. "'Win it fairly,' said the prior, "'and wear it as you will. "'I shall trust your giving true response "'on your word as a knight and as a churchman. "'Yet, brother, take my advice "'and file your tongue to a little more courtesy "'than your habits of predominating over infidel captives "'and eastern bondsmen have accustomed you. "'Cedric the Saxon, if offended, "'and he is no way slack in taking offence, "'is a man who, without respect to your knighthood, "'my high office, or the sanctity of either, "'would clear his house of us "'and send us to lodge with the larks, "'though the hour were midnight. "'And be careful how you look on Rowena, "'whom he cherishes with the most jealous care. "'An he take the least alarm in that quarter, "'we are but lost men.' It is said he banished his only son from his family for lifting his eyes in the way of affection towards this beauty, who may be worshipped, it seems, at a distance, but is not to be approached with other thoughts than such as we bring to the shrine of the Blessed Virgin.
"Well, you have said enough," answered the Templar. "I will, for a night, put on the needful restraint, and deport me as meekly as a maiden. But as for the fear of his expelling us by violence, myself and squires, with Hammett and Abdullah, will warrant you against that disgrace. Doubt not that we shall be strong enough to make good our quarters." "We must not let it come so far," answered the prior. "But here is the clown's sunken cross, and the night is so dark that we can hardly see which of the roads we're to follow. He bid us turn, I think, to the left." "To the right," said Briand, "to the best of my remembrance." "The left, certainly, the left. I remember his pointing with his wooden sword." "Aye, but he held his sword in his left hand, and so pointed across his body with it." Each maintained his opinion with sufficient obstinacy, as is usual in all such cases. The attendants were appealed to, but they had not been near enough to hear Wamba's directions. At length, Briand remarked what had at first escaped him in the twilight. "Here is someone either asleep or lying dead at the foot of this cross. Hugo, stir him with the butt-end of the lance." This was no sooner done than the figure arose, exclaiming in good French, "Whosoever thou art, it is discourteous in you to disturb my thought." "We did but wish to ask you," said the prior, "the road to Rotherwood, the abode of Cedric the Saxon." "I myself am bound thither," replied the stranger, "and if I had a horse, I would be your guide, for the way is somewhat intricate, though perfectly well known to me." "Thou shalt both have thanks and reward, my friend," said the prior, "if thou wilt bring us to Cedric's in safety." And he caused one of his attendants to mount his own led horse, and give that upon which he had hitherto ridden to the stranger, who was to serve for a guide. Their conductor pursued an opposite road from that which Wamba had recommended for the purpose of misleading them. The path soon led deeper into the woodland, and crossed more than one brook, the approach to which was rendered perilous by the marshes through which it flowed, but the stranger seemed to know, as if by instinct, the soundest ground and the safest points of passage, and by dint of caution and attention, brought the party safely into a wider avenue than any they had yet seen, and, pointing to a large, low, irregular building at the upper extremity, he said to the prior, "Yonder is Rotherwood, the dwelling of Cedric the Saxon." This was a joyful intimation to Aymer, whose nerves were none of the strongest, and who had suffered such agitation and alarm in the course of passing through the dangerous bogs that he had not yet had the curiosity to ask his guide a single question. Finding himself now at his ease and near shelter, his curiosity began to awake, and he demanded of the guide who and what he was. "A palmer, just returned from the Holy Land," was the answer. "You had better have tarried there to fight for the recovery of the Holy Sepulchre," said the Templar. "True, reverend Sir Knight," answered the palmer, to whom the appearance of the Templar seemed perfectly familiar, "but when those who are under oath to recover the Holy City are found travelling at such a distance from the scene of their duties, can you wonder that a peaceful peasant like me should decline the task which they have abandoned?" The Templar would have made an angry reply, but was interrupted by the prior, who again expressed his astonishment that their guide, after such long absence, should be so perfectly acquainted with the passes of the forest. "I was born a native of these parts," answered their guide, and as he made the reply, they stood before the mansion of Cedric, a low, irregular building containing several courtyards or enclosures, extending over a considerable space of ground, and which, though its size argued the inhabitant to be a person of wealth, differed entirely from the tall, turreted, and castellated buildings in which the Norman nobility resided, and which had become the universal style of architecture throughout England. Rotherwood was not, however, without defences. No habitation in that disturbed period could have been so, without the risk of being plundered and burnt before the next morning. A deep fosse or ditch was drawn round the whole building and filled with water from a neighbouring stream. A double stockade or palisade, composed of pointed beams which the adjacent forest supplied, defended the outer and inner bank of the fosse.
There was an entrance from the west through the outer stockade, which communicated by a drawbridge, with a similar opening in the interior defences. Some precautions had been taken to place those entrances under the protection of projecting angles, by which they might be flanked, in case of need, by archers or slingers. Before this entrance, the Templar wound his horn loudly, for the rain, which had long threatened, began now to descend with great violence. Chapter 3. Then, sad relief, from the bleak coast that hears the German ocean roar, deep-blooming, strong and yellow-haired, the blue-eyed Saxon came. Thompson's Liberty. In a hall, the height of which was greatly disproportioned to its extreme length and width, a long oaken table, formed of planks rough-hewn from the forest, and which had scarcely received any polish, stood ready prepared for the evening meal of Cedric the Saxon. The roof, composed of beams and rafters, had nothing to divide the apartment from the sky excepting the planking and thatch. There was a huge fireplace at either end of the hall, but as the chimneys were constructed in a very clumsy manner, at least as much of the smoke found its way into the apartment as escaped by the proper vent. The constant vapour which this occasioned had polished the rafters and beams of the low-browed hall by encrusting them with a black varnish of soot. On the sides of the apartment hung implements of war and of the chase, and there were at each corner folding doors which gave access to other parts of the extensive building. The other appointments of the mansion partook of the rude simplicity of the Saxon period, which Cedric piqued himself upon maintaining. The floor was composed of earth mixed with lime, trodden into such a hard substance as is often employed in flooring our modern barns. For about one quarter of the length of the apartment, the floor was raised by a step, and this space, which was called the dais, was occupied only by the principal members of the family and visitors of distinction. For this purpose, a table richly covered with scarlet cloth was placed transversely across the platform, from the middle of which ran the longer and lower board at which the domestics and inferior persons fed, down towards the bottom of the hall. The whole resembled the form of the letter T, or some of those ancient dinner tables which, arranged on the same principle, may be still seen in the antique colleges of Oxford and Cambridge. Massive chairs and settles of carved oak were placed upon the dais, and over these seats and the more elevated table was fastened a canopy of cloth, which served in some degree to protect the dignitaries who occupied that distinguished station from the weather and from the rain, which in some places found its way through the ill-constructed roof. The walls of this upper end of the hall, as far as the dais extended, were covered with hangings or curtains, and upon the floor there was a carpet, both of which were adorned with some attempts at tapestry or embroidery, executed in brilliant or rather with gaudy colouring. Over the lower range of table, the roof, as we have noticed, had no covering. The rough plastered walls were left bare, and the rude earthen floor was uncarpeted. The board was uncovered by a cloth, and rude massive benches supplied the place of chairs. In the centre of the upper table were placed two chairs more elevated than the rest, for the master and mistress of the family who presided over the scene of hospitality, and from doing so derived their Saxon title of honour, which signifies the dividers of bread. To each of these chairs was added a footstool, curiously carved and inlaid with ivory, which mark of distinction was peculiar to them. One of these seats was at present occupied by Cedric the Saxon, who, though but in rank a thane, or as the Normans called him, a franklin, felt, at the delay of his evening meal, an irritable impatience, which might have become an alderman, whether of ancient or of modern times. It appeared, indeed, from the countenance of this proprietor, that he was of a frank but hasty and choleric temper. He was not above the middle stature, but broad-shouldered, long-armed and powerfully made, like one accustomed to endure the fatigue of war or of the chase. His face was broad, with large blue eyes, open and frank features, fine teeth, and a well-formed head, altogether expressive of that sort of good humour which often lodges with a sudden and hasty temper. Pride and jealousy there was in his eye, for his life had been spent in asserting rights which were constantly liable to invasion, and the prompt, fiery, and resolute disposition of the man had been kept constantly upon the alert by the circumstances of his situation. His long yellow hair was equally divided upon the top of his head and upon his brow, and combed down on each side to the length of his shoulders. It had but little tendency to grey, although Cedric was approaching to his 60th year. His dress was a tunic of forest green, furred at the throat and cuffs with what was called miniver, a kind of fur inferior in quality to ermine, and formed, it is believed, of the skin of the grey squirrel. This doublet hung unbuttoned over a close dress of scarlet, which sat tight to his body. He had breeches of the same, but they did not reach lower than the thigh, leaving the knee exposed. His feet had sandals of the same fashion with the peasants, but of finer materials, and secured in the front with golden clasps. He had bracelets of gold upon his arms, and a broad collar of the same precious metal around his neck. About his waist he wore a richly studded belt, in which was stuck a short, straight, two-edged sword with a sharp point, so disposed as to hang almost perpendicularly by his side. Behind his seat was hung a scarlet cloth cloak, lined with fur, and a cap of the same materials, richly embroidered, which completed the dress of the opulent landholder when he chose to go forth. A short boar spear, with a broad and bright steel head, also reclined against the back of his chair, which served him, when he walked abroad, for the purposes of a staff or of a weapon, as chance might require. Several domestics, whose dress held various proportions betwixt the richness of their masters and the coarse and simple attire of Gurth the swineherd, watched the looks and waited the commands of the Saxon dignitary. Two or three servants of a superior order stood behind their master upon the dais. The rest occupied the lower part of the hall. Other attendants there were of a different description. Two or three large and shaggy greyhounds, such as were then employed in hunting the stag and wolf, as many slow hounds of a large bony breed, with thick necks, large heads, and long ears, and one or two of the smaller dogs, now called terriers, which waited with impatience the arrival of the supper, but with the sagacious knowledge of physiognomy peculiar to their race, forbore to intrude upon the moody silence of their master, apprehensive probably of a small white truncheon which lay by Cedric's trencher for the purpose of repelling the advances of his four-legged dependents. One grisly old wolf-dog alone, with the liberty of an indulged favourite, had planted himself close by the chair of state, and occasionally ventured to solicit notice by putting his large hairy head upon his master's knee, or pushing his nose into his hand. Even he was repelled by the stern command, "Down, Balder, down! I'm not in the humour for foolery." In fact, Cedric, as we have observed, was in no very placid state of mind. The Lady Rowena, who had been absent to attend an evening mass at a distant church, had but just returned, and was changing her garments, which had been wetted by the storm. There were as yet no tidings of Gurth and his charge, which should long since have been driven home from the forest, and such was the insecurity of property as to render it probable that the delay would be explained by some depredation of the outlaws, with whom the neighbouring forest abounded, or by the violence of some neighbouring baron, whose consciousness of strength made him equally negligent of the laws of property. The matter was of consequence, for great part of the domestic wealth of the Saxon proprietors consisted in numerous herds of swine, especially in forest land, where these animals easily found their food. Besides these subjects of anxiety, the Saxon thane was impatient for the presence of his favourite clown, Womba, whose jests, such as they were, served for a sort of seasoning to his evening meal and to the deep draughts of wine with which he was in the habit of accompanying it. Add to all this, Cedric had not fed since noon, and his usual supper hour was long past, a cause of irritation common to country squires, both in ancient and modern times. His displeasure was expressed in broken sentences, partly muttered to himself, partly addressed to the domestics who stood around, and particularly to his cupbearer, who offered him from time to time, as a sedative, a silver goblet filled with wine.
"Why tarries the Lady Rowena?"
"She is but changing her headgear," replied a female attendant, with as much confidence as the favourite lady's maid usually answers the master of a modern family. "You would not wish her to sit down to the banquet in her wet hood and kirtle, and no lady within the shire can be quicker in arraying herself than my mistress."
This undeniable argument produced a sort of acquiescent oomph on the part of the Saxon, with the addition, "I wish her devotion may choose fair weather for the next visit to St. John's Kirk. But what in the name of 10 devils?" continued he, turning to the cupbearer, and raising his voice as if happy to have found a channel into which he might divert his indignation without fear or control,
"what in the name of 10 devils keeps Girth so long afield? I suppose we shall have an evil account of the herd. He was wont to be a faithful and cautious drudge, and I destined him for something better. Perchance I might even have made him one of my warders."
Oswald, the cupbearer, modestly suggested that it was scarce an hour since the tolling of the curfew, an ill-chosen apology, since it turned upon a topic so harsh to Saxon ears.
"The foul fiend!" exclaimed Cedric. "Take the curfew bell, and the tyrannical bastard by whom it was devised, and the heartless slave who names it with a Saxon tongue to a Saxon ear! The curfew!" he added, pausing. "Aye, the curfew! Which compels true men to extinguish their lights, that thieves and robbers may work their deeds in darkness. Aye, the curfew, Reginald Front de Boeuf and Philippe de Malvoisin know the use of the curfew as well as William the Bastard himself, or e'er a Norman adventurer that fought at Hastings. I shall hear, I guess, that my property has been swept off to save from starving the hungry banditti, whom they cannot support but by theft and robbery. My faithful slave is murdered, my goods are taken for a prey, and Wamba! Where is Wamba? Said not someone he had gone forth with Girth?"
Oswald replied in the affirmative.
"Aye, why, this is better and better. He is carried off too, the Saxon fool, to serve the Norman lord. Fools are we all indeed that serve them, and fitter subjects for their scorn and laughter than if we were born with but half our wits. But I will be avenged," he added,
starting from his chair in impatience at the supposed injury, and catching hold of his boar spear.
"I will go with my complaint to the great council. I have friends, I have followers. Man to man will I appeal the Norman to the lists. Let him come in his plate and his mail, and all that can render cowardice bold. I have sent such a javelin as this through a stronger fence than 3 of their war shields. Happily they think me old, but they shall find, alone and childless as I am, the blood of Hereward is in the veins of Cedric." "Ah, Wilfred, Wilfred," he exclaimed in a lower tone, "couldst thou have ruled thine unreasonable passion, thy father had not been left in his age, like the solitary oak that throws out its shattered and unprotected branches against the full sweep of the tempest."
The reflection seemed to conjure into sadness his irritated feelings. Replacing his javelin, he resumed his seat, bent his looks downward, and appeared to be absorbed in melancholy reflection. From his musing, Cedric was suddenly awakened by the blast of a horn, which was replied to by the clamorous yells and barking of all the dogs in the hall, and some 20 or 30 which were quartered in other parts of the building. It cost much exercise of the white truncheon, well seconded by the exertions of the domestics, to silence this canine clamour.
"To the gate, knaves!"
said the Saxon hastily, as soon as the tumult was so much appeased that the dependents could hear his voice.
"See what tidings that horn tells of! To announce, I ween, some heirship and robbery which has been done upon my lands."
Returning in less than 3 minutes, a warder announced that the prior Aymer of Jorvaux and the good knight Brion de Bois-Guilbert, commander of the valiant and venerable order of Knights Templars,
with a small retinue, requested hospitality and lodging for the night, being on their way to a tournament which was to be held not far from Ashby de la Zouche on the second day from the present.
Aymer, the prior Aymer, Brion de Bois-Guilbert, muttered Cedric, Normans both. But Norman or Saxon, the hospitality of Rotherwood must not be impeached. They are welcome, since they have chosen to halt. More welcome would they have been to have ridden further on their way, but it were unworthy to murmur for a night's lodging and a night's food. In the quality of guests, at least, even Normans must suppress their insolence. Go, Hundebert, he added to a sort of major domo who stood behind him with a white wand. Take six of the attendants and introduce the strangers to the guests' lodging. Look after the horses and mules and see their train like nothing. Let them have change of vestments if they require it, and fire, and water to wash, and wine and ale, and bid the cooks add what they hastily can to our evening meal, and let it be put on the board when those strangers are ready to share it. Say to them, Hundebert, that Cedric would himself bid them welcome, but he is under a vow never to step more than 3 steps from the dais of his own hall to meet any who shares not the blood of Saxon royalty. Begone. See them carefully tended. Let them not say in their pride the Saxon churl has shown at once his poverty and his avarice. The major-domo departed with several attendants to execute his master's commands. The prior Aymer, repeated Cedric, looking to Oswald. The brother, if I mistake not, of Gilles de Molivre, now Lord of Middleham. Oswald made a respectful sign of assent. His brother sits in the seat and usurps the patrimony of a better race, the race of Ulfgar of Middleham. But what Norman lord doth not the same? This prior is, they say, a free and jovial priest who loves the wine cup and the bugle horn better than bell and book. Good, let him come, he shall be welcome. How named you the Templar?
Brian de Bois-Guilbert.
Bois-Guilbert,
said Cedric, still in the musing, self-arguing tone, which the habit of living among dependents had accustomed him to employ, and which resembled a man who talks to himself rather than to those around him.
Bois-Guilbert, that name has been spread wide both for good and evil. They say he is valiant as the bravest of his order, but stained with their usual vices, pride, arrogance, cruelty, and voluptuousness. A hard-hearted man, who knows neither fear of earth nor awe of heaven. So say the few warriors who have returned from Palestine. Well, it is but for one night, and shall be welcome too. Oswald, broach the oldest wine-cask. Place the best mead, the richest morat, the most sparkling cider, the most odoriferous pigment upon the board. Fill the largest horns. Templars and abbots love good wines and good measure. Elgitha, let thy Lady Rowena know we shall not this night expect her in the hall, unless such be her especial pleasure.
But it will be her especial pleasure, answered Elgitha with great readiness, for she is ever desirous to hear the latest news from Palestine. Cedric darted at the forward damsel a glance of hasty resentment, but Rowena and whatever belonged to her were privileged and secure from his anger. He only replied, Silence, maiden, thy tongue outruns thy discretion. Say my message to thy mistress, and let her do her pleasure. Here, at least, the descendant of Alfred still reigns a princess. Elgitha left the apartment.
Palestine, repeated the Saxon. Palestine. How many ears are turned to the tales which dissolute crusaders or hypocritical pilgrims bring from that fatal land? I too might ask, I too might inquire, I too might listen with a beating heart to fables which the wily strollers devise to cheat us into hospitality. But no, the son who has disobeyed me is no longer mine, nor will I concern myself more for his fate than for that of the most worthless among the millions that ever shaped the cross on their shoulder, rushed into excess and blood guiltiness, and called it an accomplishment of the will of God. He knit his brows,
and fixed his eyes for an instant on the ground. As he raised them, the folding doors at the bottom of the hall were cast wide, and, preceded by the major domo with his wand and four domestics bearing blazing torches, the guests of the evening entered the apartment. Chapter 4. With sheep and shaggy goats the porkers bled, and the proud steer was on the marble spread. With fire prepared they deal the morsels round, wine rosy bright the brimming goblets crowned. Disposed apart, Ulysses shares the treat, a trivet table and ignobler seat the prince assigns. Odyssey, Book 21. The prior Aymer had taken the opportunity afforded him of changing his riding robe for one of yet more costly materials, over which he wore a cope curiously embroidered. Besides the huge golden signet ring which marked his ecclesiastical dignity, his fingers, though contrary to the canon, were loaded with precious gems. His sandals were of the finest leather which was imported from Spain, his beard trimmed to as small dimensions as his order would possibly permit, and his shaven crown concealed by a scarlet cap, richly embroidered. The appearance of the Knight Templar was also changed, and, though less studiously bedecked with ornament, his dress was as rich and his appearance far more commanding than that of his companion. He had exchanged his shirt of mail for an undertunic of dark purple silk, garnished with furs, over which flowed his long robe of spotless white in ample folds. The eight-pointed cross of his order was cut on the shoulder of his mantle in black velvet. The high cap no longer invested his brows, which were only shaded by short and thick curled hair of a raven blackness, corresponding to his unusually swart complexion. Nothing could be more majestic than his step and manner, had they not been marked by a predominant air of haughtiness, easily acquired by the exercise of unresisted authority. These two dignified persons were followed by their respective attendants, and at a more humble distance by their guide, whose figure had nothing more remarkable than it derived from the usual weeds of a pilgrim. A cloak or mantle of coarse black serge enveloped his whole body. It was in shape something like the cloak of a modern hussar, having similar flaps for covering the arms, and was called a sclavin or Slavonian. Coarse sandals bound with thongs on his bare feet, a broad and shadowy hat with cockle shells stitched on its brim, and a long staff shod with iron, to the upper end of which was attached a branch of palm, completed the palmer's attire. He followed modestly the last of the train which entered the hall, and, observing that the lower table scarce afforded room sufficient for the domestics of Cedric and the retinue of his guests, he withdrew to a settle, placed beside and almost under one of the large chimneys, and seemed to employ himself in drying his garments, until the retreat of someone should make room at the board, or the hospitality of the steward should supply him with refreshments in the place he had chosen apart. Cedric rose to receive his guests with an air of dignified hospitality, and, descending from the dais, or elevated part of his hall, made three steps towards them, and then awaited their approach.
"I grieve," he said, "Reverend Prior, that my vow binds me to advance no farther upon this floor of my father's, even to receive such guests as you, and this valiant knight of the Holy Temple. But my steward has expounded to you the cause of my seeming discourtesy. Let me also pray that you will excuse my speaking to you in my native language, and that you will reply in the same, if your knowledge of it permits. If not, I sufficiently understand Norman to follow your meaning."
"Vows," said the abbot, "must be unloosed, worthy Franklin, or, permit me rather to say, worthy Thane, though the title is antiquated.
Vows are the knots which tie us to heaven. They are the cords which bind the sacrifice to the horns of the altar, and are therefore, as I said before, to be unloosed and discharged, unless our Holy Mother Church shall pronounce the contrary.
And respecting language, I willingly hold communication in that spoken by my respected grandmother, Hilda of Middleham, who died in odour of sanctity, little short, if we may presume to say so, of her glorious namesake, the blessed Saint Hilda of Whitby, God be gracious to her soul. When the prior had ceased what he meant as a conciliatory harangue, his companion said briefly and emphatically, "I speak ever French, the language of King Richard and his nobles, but I understand English sufficiently to communicate with the natives of the country." Cedric darted at the speaker one of those hasty and impatient glances which comparisons between the two rival nations seldom failed to call forth, but, recollecting the duties of hospitality, he suppressed further show of resentment, and, motioning with his hand, caused his guests to assume two seats a little lower than his own, but placed close beside him, and gave a signal that the evening meal should be placed upon the board. While the attendants hastened to obey Cedric's commands, his eye distinguished Girth the swineherd, who, with his companion Womba, had just entered the hall.
"Send these loitering knaves up hither," said the Saxon impatiently. And when the culprits came before the dais, "How comes it, villains, that you have loitered abroad so late as this? Hast thou brought home thy charge, Sirrah Girth, or hast thou left them to outlaws and marauders?" "The earth is safe, so please you," said Girth. "But it does not please me, thou knave," said Cedric, "that I should be made to suppose otherwise for 2 hours, and sit here devising vengeance against my neighbours for wrongs they have not done me. I tell thee, shackles and the prison-house shall punish the next offence of this kind."
Girth, knowing his master's irritable temper, attempted no exculpation, but the jester, who could presume upon Cedric's tolerance, by virtue of his privileges as a fool, replied for them both,
"In truth, Uncle Cedric, you are neither wise nor reasonable tonight."
"Oh, sir," said his master, "you shall to the porter's lodge and taste of the discipline there if you give your foolery such license."
"First, let your wisdom tell me," said Womba, "is it just and reasonable to punish one person for the fault of another?"
"Certainly not, fool," answered Cedric.
"Then why should you shackle poor Girth, uncle, for the fault of his dog Fangs? For I dare be sworn we lost not a minute by the way when we'd got our herd together, which Fangs did not manage until we heard the vesper bell."
"Then hang up Fangs," said Cedric, turning hastily towards the swineherd, "if the fault is his, and get thee another dog."
"Under favour, uncle," said the jester, "that was still somewhat on the bow hand of fair justice. For it was no fault of Fangs that he was lame and could not gather the herd, but the fault of those that struck off two of his foreclaws, an operation for which, if the poor fellow had been consulted, he would scarce have given his voice."
"And who dared to lame an animal which belonged to my bondsman?" said the Saxon, kindling in wrath.
"Marry, that did old Hubert," said Womba. "Sir Philip de Malvoisin's keeper of the chase, he caught Fangs strolling in the forest, and said he chased the deer, contrary to his master's right, as warden of the walk."
"The foul fiend take Malvoisin," answered the Saxon, "and his keeper both. I will teach him that the wood was disforested in terms of the Great Forest Charter. But enough of this. Go to, knave, go to thy place, and thou, Girth, get thee another dog. And should the keeper dare to touch it, I will mar his archery. The curse of a coward on my head, if I strike not off the forefinger of his right hand, he shall draw bowstring no more." "I crave your pardon, my worthy guests. I am beset here with neighbours that match your infidels, sir knight, in a holy land. But your homely fare is before you. Feed, and let welcome make amends for hard fare."
The feast, however, which was spread upon the board, needed no apologies from the lord of the mansion. Swine's flesh, dressed in several modes, appeared on the lower part of the board, as also that of fowls, deer, goats and hares, and various kinds of fish, together with huge loaves and cakes of bread, and sundry confections made of fruits and honey. The smaller sorts of wildfowl, of which there was abundance, were not served up in platters, but brought in upon small wooden spits or brooches, and offered by the pages and domestics who bore them to each guest in succession, who cut from them such a portion as he pleased. Beside each person of rank was placed a goblet of silver. The lower board was accommodated with large drinking horns. When the repast was about to commence, the major-domo, or steward, suddenly raising his wand, said aloud, "Forbear! Place for the Lady Rowena!" A side door at the upper end of the hall now opened behind the banquet table, and Rowena, followed by four female attendants, entered the apartment. Cedric, though surprised, and perhaps not altogether agreeably so, at his ward appearing in public upon this occasion, hastened to meet her, and to conduct her, with respectful ceremony, to the elevated seat at his own right hand, appropriated to the lady of the mansion. All stood up to receive her, and replying to their courtesy by a mute gesture of salutation, she moved gracefully forwards to assume her place at the board. Ere she had time to do so, the Templar whispered to the prior, "I shall wear no colour of gold of yours at the tournament. The Cayenne wine is your own."
"Said I not so?" answered the prior.
"But check your raptures. The Franklin observes you." Unheeding this remonstrance, and accustomed only to act upon the immediate impulse of his own wishes, Brian de Bois-Guilbert kept his eyes riveted on the Saxon beauty, more striking perhaps to his imagination because differing widely from those of the eastern sultanas. Formed in the best proportions of her sex, Rowena was tall in stature, yet not so much so as to attract observation on account of superior height. Her complexion was exquisitely fair, but the noble cast of her head and features prevented the insipidity which sometimes attaches to fair beauties. Her clear blue eye, which sat enshrined beneath a graceful eyebrow of brown sufficiently marked to give expression to the forehead, seemed capable to kindle as well as melt, to command as well as to beseech. If mildness were the more natural expression of such a combination of features, it was plain that, in the present instance, the exercise of habitual superiority and the reception of general homage had given to the Saxon lady a loftier character, which mingled with and qualified that bestowed by nature. Her profuse hair, of a colour betwixt brown and flaxen, was arranged in a fanciful and graceful manner in numerous ringlets, to form which art had probably aided nature. These locks were braided with gems, and, being worn at full length, intimated the noble birth and free-born condition of the maiden. A golden chain, to which was attached a small reliquary of the same metal, hung round her neck. She wore bracelets on her arms, which were bare. Her dress was an undergown and kirtle of pale sea-green silk, over which hung a long, loose robe which reached to the ground, having very wide sleeves, which came down, however, very little below the elbow. This robe was crimson, and manufactured out of the very finest wool. A veil of silk, interwoven with gold, was attached to the upper part of it, which could be, at the wearer's pleasure, either drawn over the face and bosom, after the Spanish fashion, or disposed as a sort of drapery round the shoulders. When Rowena perceived the Knight Templar's eyes bent on her with an ardour that, compared with the dark caverns under which they moved, gave them the effect of lighted charcoal, she drew with dignity the veil around her face, as an intimation that the determined freedom of his glance was disagreeable. Cedric saw the motion and its cause.
"Sir Templar," said he, "the cheeks of our Saxon maidens have seen too little of the sun to enable them to bear the fixed glance of a crusader." "If I have offended," replied Sir Brian, "I crave your pardon. That is, I crave the Lady Rowena's pardon, for my humility will carry me no lower."
"The Lady Rowena," said the prior, "has punished us all in chastising the boldness of my friend. Let me hope she will be less cruel to the splendid train which are to meet at the tournament."
"Our going thither," said Cedric, "is uncertain. I love not these vanities, which were unknown to my fathers when England was free."
"Let us hope, nevertheless," said the prior, "our company may determine you to travel thitherward,
When the roads are so unsafe, the escort of Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert is not to be despised.
Sir Prior, answered the Saxon, wheresoever I have travelled in this land, I have hitherto found myself, with the assistance of my good sword and faithful followers, in no respect needful of other aid. At present, if we indeed journey to Ashby de la Zouche, we do so with my noble neighbour and countryman, Athelstane of Coningsborough, and with such a train as would set outlaws and feudal enemies alike at defiance. I drink to you, Sir Prior, in this cup of wine, which I trust your taste will approve, and I thank you for your courtesy. Should you be so rigid in adhering to monastic rule, he added, as to prefer your acid preparation of milk, I hope you will not strain courtesy to do me reason. Nay, said the priest, laughing, it is only in our abbey that we confine ourselves to the lac dulce, or the lac acidum either. Conversing with the world, we use the world's fashions, and therefore I answer your pledge in this honest wine, and leave the weaker liquor to my lay brother. And I, said the Templar, filling his goblet, drink wassail to the fair Rowena, for, since her namesake introduced the word into England, has never been one more worthy of such a tribute. By my faith, I could pardon the unhappy Vortigern, had he half the cause that we now witness for making shipwreck of his honour and his kingdom.
I will spare your courtesy, Sir Knight, said Rowena with dignity, and without unveiling herself. Or rather I will tax it so far as to require of you the latest news from Palestine, a theme more agreeable to our English ears than the compliments which your French breeding teaches.
I have little of importance to say, lady, answered Sir Brian de Bois-Guilbert, excepting the confirmed tidings of a truce with Saladin.
He was interrupted by Wamba, who had taken his appropriated seat upon a chair, the back of which was decorated with two ass's ears, and which was placed about two steps behind that of his master, who from time to time supplied him with victuals from his own trencher, a favour, however, which the jester shared with the favourite dogs, of whom, as we have already noticed, there were several in attendance. Here sat Wamba, with a small table before him, his heels tucked up against the bar of the chair, his cheeks sucked up so as to make his jaws resemble a pair of nutcrackers, and his eyes half shut, yet watching with alertness every opportunity to exercise his licensed foolery.
"These truces with the infidels," he exclaimed,
without caring how suddenly he interrupted the stately Templar,
"make an old man of me."
"Go to, knave, how so?"
said Cedric, his features prepared to receive favourably the expected jest.
"Because," answered Wamba, "I remember three of them in my day, each of which was to endure for the course of 50 years, so that, by computation, I must be at least 150 years old."
"I will warrant you against dying of old age, however," said the Templar, who now recognised his friend of the forest. "I will assure you from all deaths but a violent one, if you give such directions to wayfarers as you did this night to the Prior and me."
"How, sirrah?" said Cedric. "Misdirect travellers? We must have you whipped. You are at least as much rogue as fool."
"I pray thee, uncle," answered the jester, "let my folly for once protect my roguery. I did but make a mistake between my right hand and my left, and he might have pardoned a greater who took a fool for his counsellor and guide."
Conversation was here interrupted by the entrance of the porter's page, who announced that there was a stranger at the gate, imploring admittance and hospitality.
"Admit him," said Cedric, "be he who or what he may. A knight like that which roars without compels even wild animals to herd with tame, and to seek the protection of man, their mortal foe, rather than perish by the elements. Let his wants be ministered to with all care. Look to it, Oswald."
And the steward left the banqueting hall to see the commands of his patron obeyed. Chapter 5.
Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions?
fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer, as a Christian is? Merchant of Venice. Oswald, returning, whispered into the ear of his master, "It is a Jew who calls himself Isaac of York. Is it fit I should marshal him into the hall?" "Let Girth do thine office, Oswald," said Wamba with his usual effrontery. "The swineherd will be a fit usher to the Jew."
"St. Mary," said the abbot, crossing himself, "an unbelieving Jew, and admitted into this presence."
"A dog Jew," echoed the Templar, "to approach a defender of the Holy Sepulchre."
"By my faith," said Wamba, "it would seem the Templars love the Jews' inheritance better than they do their company."
"Peace, my worthy guests," said Cedric. "My hospitality must not be bounded by your dislikes. If heaven bore with a whole nation of stiff-necked unbelievers for more years than a layman can number, we may endure the presence of one Jew for a few hours. But I constrain no man to converse or to feed with him. Let him have a board and morsel apart. Unless," he said, smiling, "these turbaned strangers will admit his society."
"Sir Franklin," answered the Templar, "my Saracen slaves are true Muslims, and scorn as much as any Christian to hold intercourse with a Jew."
"Now, in faith," said Wamba, "I cannot see that the worshippers of Mahound and Termagant have so greatly the advantage over the people once chosen of heaven."
"He shall sit with thee, Wamba," said Cedric. "The fool and the knave will be well met."
"The fool," answered Wamba, raising the relics of a gammon of bacon, "will take care to erect a bulwark against the knave."
"Hush," said Cedric, "for here he comes."
Introduced with little ceremony, and advancing with fear and hesitation, and many a bow of deep humility, a tall, thin old man, who, however, had lost, by the habit of stooping, much of his actual height, approached the lower end of the board. His features, keen and regular, with an aquiline nose and piercing black eyes, his high and wrinkled forehead and long grey hair and beard, would have been considered as handsome had they not been the marks of a physiognomy peculiar to a race which, during these dark ages, was alike detested by the credulous and prejudiced vulgar and persecuted by the greedy and rapacious nobility, and who, perhaps, owing to that very hatred and persecution, had adopted a national character in which there was much, to say the least, mean and unamiable. The Jew's dress, which appeared to have suffered considerably from the storm, was a plain russet cloak of many folds, covering a dark purple tunic. He had large boots lined with fur and a belt around his waist, which sustained a small knife, together with a case for writing materials, but no weapon. He wore a high, square, yellow cap of a peculiar fashion, assigned to his nation to distinguish them from Christians, and which he doffed with great humility at the door of the hall. The reception of this person in the hall of Cedric the Saxon was such as might have satisfied the most prejudiced enemy of the tribes of Israel. Cedric himself coldly nodded in answer to the Jew's repeated salutations, and signed to him to take place at the lower end of the table, where, however, no one offered to make room for him. On the contrary, as he passed along the file, casting a timid, supplicating glance, and turned towards each of those who occupied the lower end of the board, the Saxon domestics squared their shoulders and continued to devour their supper with great perseverance, paying not the least attention to the wants of the new guest. The attendants of the abbot crossed themselves with looks of pious horror, and the very heathen Saracens, as Isaac drew near them, curled up their whiskers with indignation and laid their hands on their poniards, as if ready to rid themselves by the most desperate means from the apprehended contamination of his nearer approach. Probably the same motives which induced Cedric to open his hall to this son of a rejected people would have made him insist on his attendants receiving Isaac with more courtesy, but the abbot had, at this moment, engaged him in a most interesting discussion on the breed and character of his favourite hounds, which she would not have interrupted for matters of much greater importance than that of a Jew going to bed supperless. While Isaac thus stood an outcast in the present society, like his people among the nations, looking in vain for welcome or resting place, the pilgrim, who sat by the chimney, took compassion upon him and resigned his seat, saying briefly, "Old man, my garments are dried, my hunger is appeased. Thou art both wet and fasting." So saying, he gathered together and brought to a flame the decaying brands which lay scattered on the ample hearth, took from the larger board a mess of pottage and seethed kid, placed it upon the small table at which he had himself supped, and, without waiting the Jew's thanks, went to the other side of the hall, whether from unwillingness to hold more close communication with the object of his benevolence, or from a wish to draw near to the upper end of the table, seemed uncertain. Had there been painters in those days capable to execute such a subject, the Jew, as he bent his withered form and expanded his chilled and trembling hands over the fire, would have formed no bad emblematical personification of the winter season. Having dispelled the cold, he turned eagerly to the smoking mess which was placed before him, and eat with a haste and an apparent relish that seemed to betoken long abstinence from food. Meanwhile, the abbot and Cedric continued their discourse upon hunting. The Lady Rowena seemed engaged in conversation with one of her attendant females, and the haughty Templar, whose eye seemed to wander from the Jew to the Saxon beauty, revolved in his mind thoughts which appeared deeply to interest him.
"I marvel, worthy Cedric," said the abbot as their discourse proceeded, "that great as your predilection is for your own manly language, you do not at least receive the Norman French into your favour, so far as the mystery of woodcraft and hunting is concerned. Surely no tongue is so rich in the various phrases which the field sports demand, or furnishes means to the experienced woodsman so well to express his jovial art."
"Good Father Aymer," said the Saxon, "be it known to you, I care not for those oversea refinements, without which I can well enough take my pleasure in the woods. I can wind my horn, though I call not the blast either a recheat or a mort. I can cheer my dogs on the prey, and I can flay and quarter the animal when it is brought down, without using the new-fangled jargon of curé, arbor, nombles, and all the babble of the fabulous Sir Tristram."
"The French," said the Templar, raising his voice with the presumptuous and authoritative tone which he used upon all occasions, "is not only the natural language of the chase, but that of love and of war, in which ladies should be won and enemies defied."
"Pledge me in a cup of wine, Sir Templar," said Cedric, "and fill another to the abbot, while I look back some 30 years to tell you another tale. As Cedric the Saxon then was, his plain English tale needed no garnish from French troubadours when it was told in the ear of beauty, and the field of Northallerton, upon the day of the Holy Standard, could tell whether the Saxon war cry was not heard as far within the ranks of the Scottish host as the cri de guerre of the boldest Norman baron. To the memory of the brave who fought there, pledge me, my guests."
He drank deep and went on with increasing warmth.
"Aye, that was a day of cleaving of shields, when 100 banners were bent forwards over the head of the valiant, and blood flowed round like water, and death was held better than flight. A Saxon bard had called it a feast of the swords, a gathering of the eagles to the prey, the clashing of bills upon shield and helmet, the shouting of battle more joyful than the clamour of a bridal. But our bards are no more," said he. "Our deeds are lost in those of another race. Our language, our very name, is hastening to decay, and none mourns for it save one solitary old man. Cupbearer, knave, fill the goblets. To the strong in arms, Sir Templar, be their race or language what it will, who now bear them best in Palestine among the champions of the cross."
"It becomes not one wearing this badge to answer," said Sir Briand de Bois-Guilbert. "Yet to whom, besides the sworn champions of the Holy Sepulchre,
can the palm be assigned among the champions of the cross?
To the Knights Hospitallers, said the abbot. I have a brother of their order.
I impeach not their fame, said the Templar. Nevertheless,
I think, friend Cedric, said Womba, interfering, that had Richard of the Lion's Heart been wise enough to have taken a fool's advice, he might have stayed at home with his merry Englishmen and left the recovery of Jerusalem to those same knights who had most to do with the loss of it.
Were there then none in the English army, said the Lady Rowena, whose names are worthy to be mentioned with the Knights of the Temple and of St. John?
Forgive me, lady, replied de Bois-Guilbert. The English monarch did indeed bring to Palestine a host of gallant warriors, second only to those whose breasts have been the unceasing bulwark of that blessed land.